You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Heather Doyle, and I direct the Sexual Health and Rights Project, which is part of the public health program here at the Open Society Foundations. And I'd like to welcome you to the OSF, and also thank you for coming out under a heat advisory this evening. So, and it's great to see you all here. And I guess I wanted to just talk a little bit about why we decided to do a report on this issue. And actually, it really came out of the work that we've been doing with our grantees and with our partners in the field, and hearing this issue and over again from people about how their condoms were being confiscated, either legally or illegally, and the impact that it had in terms of how they were able to protect themselves from HIV infection. And actually, what I'd like to do is just play, we actually, in addition to the reports, which are available over there, we have a video that we've produced. I'm not going to play the whole video, but we're going to play 1 minute of the video so that you can actually hear some of the stories and that we were hearing and why it compelled us to actually go ahead and do this research. Tessa?
They will take you because of the condoms that you had in your pocket, and then they arrest us.
The message is going to be sent to not carry condoms.
They give it the message that we have to protect ourselves from disease, but at the same token, they ask that I'm gonna go to jail for using a condom or for walking around with a condom. I don't understand. So now I know if I'm gonna be working on the street, I have to put the condoms, you know, putting in a very like private place, not to be found in, or basically walk around with no condoms or not use condoms at all, because I'm going to get arrested for just having one or two condoms.
Even sometimes when I'm dressed decently and I'm only having a condom in my handbag, they come and arrest me, and they don't even have evidence that I'm a sex worker.
Uma uthwele ihandbag sokutavula thulula konke lokho kuphakathi sibone ukuthi uthwele but awusozuthwala ama condom ulihule unzapana unzapana ama condom aye ure wasungwa ande ku central sokhanjiswe police.
Police destroy our condoms because they see sex workers as useless people, but a sex worker is a human being.
So with that, I actually want to turn it directly over to the panel. I'm going to introduce the moderator, who is Acacia Shields. Acacia has 15 years of experience in doing human rights research and documentation. She's formerly with the Human Rights Watch, but has luckily been with OSF, and in particular with the SHARP Project, since 2007. And most recently is the author of the report of criminalizing condoms. So, Acacia.
Heather, and thank you to everyone for joining us tonight to take a close look at how certain police practices are really jeopardizing sex workers' lives. The Criminalizing Condoms report that we're making public today and that we're going to talk about this evening is the result of a collaboration among seven sex worker rights organizations working in six different countries, in Kenya, Namibia, Russia, South Africa, the United States, and Zimbabwe. And while the situations in each of these countries is, of course, very different, and the context in which the research was done was very different, what's striking and what I think you'll hear is the similarities, the commonality in the stories that were gathered that are often very shocking. There are some countries from which we don't have representatives tonight, and so I'd like to use those as examples to give you a sense of some of the data that we gathered. In Russia, 80% of the sex workers that were surveyed, in that case it was 8 out of 10 people, said that police had taken condoms away from them. And 60%, that is 6 out of 10 sex workers surveyed, said that police had used condoms as evidence against them to support charges of prostitution. The research also showed that police are engaged in destroying sex workers' condoms. We heard stories about police burning condoms, driving over condoms with their police cars, cutting them up with scissors. In Namibia, where this was particularly prevalent, 50% of sex workers surveyed reported that they had had their condoms destroyed by police. And maybe most shockingly, 75% of those sex workers who had their condoms destroyed by police and who then went on to do sex work had unprotected sex. So we see the direct consequences of some of these police actions. And what I think the challenge for us to look at in this conversation, and I hope that we'll dig deeply into, is the question of looking beyond methods of condom promotion and condom distribution and take a real look at what happens to sex workers when they're in possession of condoms and how the actions of police officers are really thwarting sex workers' own efforts to protect their health. We're really lucky to have three outstanding experts in this field, people who know this issue inside and out, and who can help us lead us through this conversation. So I'll introduce our three speakers tonight, and then after they've each had a chance to talk, I'll ask them a few questions to get us started and open the floor to you. First, Kholi Buthelezi is here from South Africa, where she's the national coordinator for the Sizonke sex worker movement. Sean Maseko is here from the Sexual Rights Center in Zimbabwe, where she's the director of that organization. And Sienna Baskin is the co-director of the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center. Right here in New York. Thank you. Hometown. I'm going to give the floor first to Kholi. Kholi Buthelezi is a professional sex worker, and as I said, she's the national coordinator for the Sizonke sex worker movement, which is a sex worker-led organization in South Africa. She's also the country coordinator for South Africa for the Sex Worker Alliance, the African Sex Worker Alliance. Kholi said to me that she believes in sex workers as human rights defenders. And she gets her strength and feels passionate about the opportunity to educate fellow sex workers about their rights, about their health, about the chance to make their organization a stronger and more effective place. She also told me that as a child, she told her mother that she had thought about becoming a singer, and that now she feels that she is, in a way, doing that by raising her voice on behalf of fellow sex workers and their rights. So take it away, Kholi.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kholi, as I've been introduced by Akasha. I think I'm very happy to be here today, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank Uosai for inviting me to be part of this. As Akasha had said that I wanted to be a singer. By doing this, I feel like I'm still singing because I'm speaking on behalf of my colleagues and for other sex workers in other countries, not only for my country, but in so many countries. Thank you very much. I've tried to write a few things that I wanted to share with you today. And then at the end of my speaking, and then you can ask questions. What I would like to ask is not pictures of mine be taken for my respect. Please do so. To be part of this event today, this conference, it means a lot to me because these are the difficulties that we've been facing as a country coordinator of ASWA. ASWA is the African Sex Worker Alliance that is in 9 countries. So these kind of informations and difficulties are things that we come across, and it's been difficult for sex workers to protect themselves if police have been confiscating condoms. I'll start with a vulnerability. The confiscation of condoms, it makes sex workers more vulnerable to the gangsters, clients as they are street based, and police unlikely to accept complaints from them, to diseases including HIV, often to client refuse to use condom and police to tend to confiscate condoms when found on sex workers. To all forms of abuse, verbally, physically, emotionally, as there have been no support while working and often no support at home. Partners are also often violent. Around access to healthy, sex workers as all South Africans have access to free primary health care during normal working hours. In areas like Hillbro, that is in Johannesburg, Gauteng, sex workers are identified by their addresses as they are all operated from the hotel-based brothels. This is also true in Rustenburg, some areas of the Western Cape, and primarily the more rural areas. When sex workers have been raped, they have problems access healthy care. When the condom bust, the healthy care workers now insist that you bring your partner in order for you to get services. And sex workers often experience stigmatization when using healthy care facilities when they leave, as they are often recognized. Most organizations working with sex workers focus on HIV, only where areas sex workers need access to overall healthy care, including pap smear, test for cervical cancer, and breast cancer, as well as other illness that contributed to the stress they experience daily. We're also having a problem with the police interfering in outreach activities, intimidating sex workers and outreach workers by following the outreach van and questioning sex workers and outreach sex workers. In Mpumalanga, it's one of the provinces in South Africa, they claim that we are promoting sex work. For an example, in KZN, a sex worker was picked up by police and raped. When she asked them to use a condom, they refused and insisted what she knew about the condom. In this situation, the sex worker is powerless to prevent infection, even though she knew about condoms. In this situation, the sex worker is powerless to prevent. In Gauteng, police caught a sex worker with a client, and then the client was dismissed, and the police continued to rape the sex worker. In Gauteng, is one of the provinces in South Africa, a sex worker was picked up by a policeman who held a hostage for a week, raping her continuously. She did not report, as she had no support at that point. Other points to raise: in Limpopo, police search sex workers and the surrounding area to check for condoms. When they find them, they are burnt or destroyed. In Gauteng, they search them or ask them to empty their bags. If they find condoms, they are arrested and charged under the loitering bylaws or public nuisance bylaws. In Mpumalanga, police enter homes of sex workers and break down doors. If you do not respond, they search, and when they find condoms, they are destroyed. They also force the sex workers to eat condoms when they found them in their positions. In Mpumalanga, police destroyed ARVs when found on sex workers. When they return to clinic for repeat medication, they have to explain and disclose. This forces sex workers to default if they can't face healthy workers. In KZN, police search sex workers, and when they find condoms, they blow them up as balloons, and they force sex workers to wear them on their ears. They then drive behind into the van all the way while announcing over the loud hailer that they are sex workers, and that is stigmatization. They are not charged for that. I think what I wanted to share with you today, it ends there. Then you can ask questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Coley. That was incredibly powerful.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Sean Maseko, who is the director of the Sexual Rights Center in Zimbabwe. She's written extensively and presented on sexual rights and the Sexual Rights Center's work on for the LGBTI community in Zimbabwe and sex workers. She holds a master's degree from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, where she also worked on women's rights issues. And there have been some startling developments in Zimbabwe with respect to the police treatment of female sex workers and women in general. And I think we're very lucky to have Sean here today to give us an update on some of those evolving developments and as part of her discussion. So thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here as part of this panel, and it was a really important opportunity for us to be involved in this research. And I think it's very important and very significant research. So I want to start by just contextualizing a little bit. Zimbabwe is always quite an interesting context, but I think the point that I have to start with about Zimbabwe, particularly reflecting on issues affecting sex workers and the stuff that I'm going to talk about, is really about police action. There is no rule of law in Zimbabwe. We have a facade, but it's not actually a rule of law. And there is a strong disregard for human rights. The state makes comments this matter consistently and persistently, that there is a strong disregard for human rights. Obviously, the situation in Zimbabwe, the disregard for human rights has led particularly to the infringements of the rights of vulnerable and marginalized groups. And the intersectionality of stigma and discrimination particularly plays out for sex workers. And issues around discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, profession, as far as sex workers are concerned, tribe, religion, etc. As a result of the human rights crisis, the marginalization of sex workers that already existed has become even more intense and become even more severe. I think one of the most important points to raise is the issue of the police. I think all of the sex workers from Zimbabwe in the research defined their relationship with the police as bad. I think that's probably a bit of an understatement. I think that the sex workers that we work with cite the police as the most significant threat to their safety and well-being, as the number one problem. And this resonates throughout the research, where 82% sex workers cited harassment and intimidation from the police. So this is a very serious issue. And obviously, this is coupled with this issue of condom confiscation. The point about the attitudes and behavior of the police, of course, is that it removes recourse to justice. And as Coley just mentioned, it prevents sex workers from reporting cases, particularly cases of violence by the police, filing complaints against the police, and it just generally removes any legal options or avenues that sex workers might have. As Acacia mentioned, the vulnerability of women in Zimbabwe has become increasingly difficult. The vulnerability of women in general, there has been a dramatic increase of the arrests of women out at night. This is sort of, this could be 5:30, so we're not really talking night-night. Arrested for loitering, which has actually been repealed, but they're still being arrested for loitering. They're still being arrested for soliciting. So there is a general vulnerability of women in Zimbabwe around this issue, particularly as far as the police are concerned. I think one of the sex workers from Zimbabwe kind of summed it up as she said that all women are asked what they are doing outside at night. All women are asked what they are doing outside at night. 17 out of the 21 sex workers from Zimbabwe had been arrested on charges related to sex work. I want to just note that the issue of arrest in Zimbabwe, as in many countries, is very complicated. Sex workers will often be arrested, but they won't necessarily be charged. They'll be illegally detained, held in custody, and obviously this exposes them to greater risk of violence and particularly abduction by the police, but they're also often not held in police cells, which means that what happens to them can often not be documented, and it's often very difficult to trace them when we're trying to trace sex workers that have been arrested. Some of the sex workers cited possession of condoms as one of the reasons for their arrest. And I just want to highlight two issues around this. Coley has already referred to this issue of health, the fact that in Zimbabwe, in our national HIV/AIDS strategy for the country, sex workers are identified as an at-risk population. So obviously, this is a contradiction. The police actions are directly contradicting the national policy on HIV and AIDS, and that's very significant. But the second issue that I wanted to raise, it's happening in Zimbabwe, but I think it's generally reflected in all the countries where we did this research, this issue of condoms as another weapon in what I perceive as the war against sex work and sex workers. I think the issues are about the humiliating and inhumane treatment by the police in A, finding the condoms in the first place. And I'd just like to quote a sex worker from Zimbabwe, quoted in the research. They chased my friend up into her flat, had sex with her, and then took them, the condoms. So it's this humiliating and inhumane treatment in the actual finding of the condoms. A Zambian sex worker based in Namibia said, they came and asked for my bag. When I refused, they beat me, took my condoms, and said I was a bitch. I think this is then followed by the indignity, the violence, and the extortion that sex workers are subjected to following the finding, confiscation, or destruction of the condoms. I had sex with two police officers against my will. I was threatened that I would be sentenced, so I had to have sex with them. And this was a sex worker from South Africa talking about the South African police. This issue of extortion and corruption is pervasive. It comes out very strongly in the report. 18 out of the 21 sex workers from Zimbabwe reported that police had asked for bribes. Bribes, of course, not always being interpreted as money. And just as an aside, according to Transparency International report in 2011, Zimbabwe was ranked 154 out of 182 countries in terms of its level of corruption. Interestingly, the police topped the list as the institution perceived to be the most corrupt and stood out as the biggest recipient of bribes amongst service providers. I can vouch for that. The point about this is that this extortion, coupled with the condom confiscation, the threatened and the actual violence, prevents sex workers from negotiating safer sex and creates an environment of heightened insecurity and fear, which already exists in Zimbabwe. So we're talking about an exacerbated insecurity and an exacerbated fear. And obviously the question has to be the impact, what the longer term impact of this is going to be. I just wanted to briefly mention the issue of outreach workers and the harassment of outreach workers. In Zimbabwe, there weren't a huge number of outreach workers interviewed, and the issues, they were not particularly subjected to intimidation, but the issue was, of course, as one of them commented, that it was difficult to distribute condoms to sex workers while the police were harassing them. If sex workers are persistently being harassed, persistently being arrested, it is impossible to distribute condoms. And one of the reasons that we don't have many outreach workers in Zimbabwe is because of this fear and because of the fact that women are persistently being arrested at night. And I think there was a very interesting comment made by an outreach worker in Kenya about the fact that they would have meetings with sex workers and then the police would come and arrest the sex workers after the meeting. Now, we've had similar incidences of this in Zimbabwe. I just want to share one final story. This relates to a sex worker outreach worker that we work with very closely. She was recently doing outreach work in Victoria Falls, and they had accessed a huge number of sex workers, and they'd managed to speak to a lot of people. Unfortunately, while she was there, one of my other colleagues was attacked in a bar. While she was trying to get to my colleague in the police station, she was beaten by a police officer. The police officer burst her eardrum. She went immediately to report the case, to file a complaint against this plainclothes police officer. And the police tried to bribe her to drop the complaint. So she has now subsequently made 4 trips to Victoria Falls to try and file a complaint with the police in order to ensure that she gets some kind of justice. But they are making it absolutely impossible for her to do this. And this happened very recently. So I just wanted to share this with you as an illustration of some of the challenges of not only being an outreach worker and a sex worker, but also trying to be a human rights defender. And that it's complex, it's messy, and it's very, very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Our next speaker is Sienna Baskin, who is the co-director of the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center. And she not only directs fellow staff attorneys, she also works directly with clients to help them stay in secure housing, to secure their rights in family court, and to seek justice in cases of police misconduct and hate crimes. Sienna and her colleagues at the Sex Workers Project are currently advocating for passage of a law in New York that would stop police and prosecutors from confiscating condoms from sex workers or anyone, and from using them as evidence against people on charges of prostitution. I think she'll raise this in her discussion, and I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, Sienna.
Thank you. So much. I am also very honored to be with my co-panelists and to be part of this report that shows really how, even in very different countries, these same issues around sex work and criminalization, violence against sex workers, emerge. So we are here in New York City, and that's what our part of the report focused on. And so just a little context for those of you who aren't New Yorkers. We have in New York one of the highest rates of HIV infection in the country. It's 3 times the national average. 80% of new AIDS diagnoses are among Black and Latino people in New York City. We also have a really aggressive public health program. The Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in New York City has been distributing free condoms since the 70s, and just as an example, in 2009, they distributed 40 million condoms. So we have a situation where you'd think condoms would be easily accessible and destigmatized and just not a matter of difficulty at all. We found out that sex workers were experiencing having their condoms taken away from them, and having condoms used against them as evidence, and that many sex workers thought it was a crime to carry condoms or to carry a certain number of condoms. Because of this, we actually have been engaged in a campaign for 3 years now to change this policy. Not only ourselves, but there is a network of advocates in New York called the PROS Network that stands for Providers and Resources Offering Services to Sex Workers, harm reduction organizations, activists, sex workers themselves, people that care about this community. As part of this network, we actually did a study before this study in partnership with the Department of Health. We thought the Department of Health would be very concerned if condoms were being confiscated from people in New York. And then we did another study to be part of this 6-country look at the issue. So I'd like to cite some statistics about New York City, and I'll include both studies. The findings are similar to what's happening in other countries. We found in this report that around 43% of sex workers that we interviewed had condoms taken away from them by the police. In our 2010 study, it was higher, it was 57%. We found that around 52% of the sex workers we surveyed had said that there were times they did not carry condoms because they were afraid. of them causing an arrest or getting them into some kind of trouble with the police. And about half of the sex workers that had had condoms taken away from them and had gone on and done sex work after that experience had done sex work without a condom. So we think of this being maybe an issue in other countries, but it is an issue here as well. I think it relates also to an issue that is very timely in New York City, which is the stop and frisk issue. That we have a police force that engages in profiling and routine stops and frisks of large, enormous amounts of people in New York, focusing on minorities, but Black and Latino people in New York. When we did our survey, we reached a large number of people of these ethnicities. 40% of our respondents were Latino or Latina. 31% were Black or African American. 17% were of mixed race or ethnicity. Around 9% were white. And the rest were also identified as European descent. 75% of our respondents in general had been stopped and searched by the police. So this is an overlapping issue and one that we might not think about when we think about stop and frisk and how common it is. But when people are stopped and frisked, they're looking for contraband, they're looking for a way to charge someone with a crime, and they may find condoms, and that may also lead to an arrest. So I think what we really learned in New York, especially in contrast and in comparison with these other countries, is that here we are in a city where, in a country where we think we do have rule of law. and in New York, we actually have laws that enable this kind of police practice. So we really saw two kinds of abuses happen. We saw the abuse of police just acting with impunity and doing things that were illegal, like taking condoms, destroying them, cutting them up, you know, destroying people's property as a form of harassment because they can get away with it because these are sex workers and they're very dissuaded from filing complaints. But we also saw police taking condoms legitimately because it is legal to take condoms in New York as evidence of a crime. And that's because prostitution is a crime. And really anything that can be used to show a certain fact in court, if it's relevant to that fact, can be admitted in court. So we have arrest reports and arrest vouchers that have a fill-in number of condoms taken. If it's a prostitution arrest, you just fill in the number of condoms that you take. So we see these abuses sort of hiding under the cover of law, that police can say, well, this is my job. Which is why we mounted this campaign to change the law. We don't want there to be an excuse for this kind of behavior because it has such a detrimental impact. And we also saw that sex workers, when we interviewed them, didn't really distinguish between these two kinds of abuses. They felt, you know, I'm criminalized and these horrible things happen to me. And just to echo what my colleague said, I think the condoms issue was one way of unwrapping and getting at a host of police abuses that happen against sex workers. We also asked this question around, have you ever been asked for a bribe? And while none of our respondents said, oh yes, the police asked me for money, many of them responded by saying, oh, do you mean when the police asked me to have sex with them for free in exchange for not being arrested? Is that what you're talking about? And of course, we documented that. But the fact that that is so common that we didn't even have to ask it and it just emerges, I think, is a real human rights concern. I think the confiscation of condoms is one very insidious form of police abuse against sex workers, but clearly not the only kind. And it's also the kind of policy that happens when prostitution is criminalized, when sex workers are afraid to go to the police because they're for crimes against them, because they're afraid that they themselves will be arrested. When police think it is their job to arrest sex workers, therefore they think they can just harass sex workers because they're criminals. And when it can be argued that condoms are evidence of this crime. These are the kinds of practices that happen. So I think in New York we have a real potential to be a model and to make a change. When we have a strong public health policy and a strong public health program to distribute condoms, to destigmatize condoms, to make people not afraid of practicing safe sex, to educate people. And we need to bring that in sync with our criminal justice priorities. And that's what we're trying to do with our campaign around the law, which we can talk about more as well. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sim. So I'm going to exercise my prerogative as moderator and ask a few targeted questions of our speakers and then open it up to all of you for a broader discussion. And I'd like to start again with you, Coley. Sean spoke about the intimidation of outreach workers and really the police harassment of sex workers as a barrier to outreach workers being able to do their job. And I know that the research showed that in many times in South Africa, but also in Kenya, we saw this in Namibia, outreach workers are targeted directly by police. And I wonder if you could talk about how that plays out and also about how that affects the sex worker, outreach worker relationship that's so vital to accessing sex workers and getting them the health care they need. Thank you. Yeah, lean forward and start, and we'll see. It worked.
That's sorted out.
Firstly, I would like to tell you that our outreach workers in South Africa, most of the organizations that work with sex workers, our outreach workers are peer educators. The peer educators are sex workers. I think this is a bigger problem for us in South Africa. If police are the ones that are coming to sex workers and they don't know that they're sex workers, but if are the ones that intervening in this situation, if sex workers does have to access healthy facilities, I think it's a bigger problem for us. It is something that we have to deal with, yes.
Thank you. And Sean, I think there are a lot of brutal stories that we've just heard, and you quoted some of the sex workers who were interviewed for the report. I wonder if you could maybe address what some people may be thinking, which is, you know, these are the acts of some really terrible police officers, that this is just the product of a few bad apples, a few renegade police officers.
Okay. Oh, for the bad apple. I think I can safely say that it's not rogue police officers. I think that there are bigger issues here. One of the issues that I didn't mention, obviously, is that of impunity. I mean, there is a generally unspoken impunity around particular groups that are targeted by the police, sex workers being one of them, but the LGBTI community being another, that acts of violence perpetrated by police against these groups generally have some kind of impunity and silence that surrounds them. But I also think that it is coming from a wider agenda. I mean, I think that the Zimbabwean government has spoken openly about being in opposition to prostitution. At the recent CEDAW constructive dialogue, they talked about the need to eradicate prostitution. Of course, I mean, in theory, campaigns to end sex work are not uncommon. But I think the issue is that it's about the reason behind that campaign. And I think that from the perspective of the Zimbabwean government, and I suspect it's probably very similar in South Africa, the issue is not about protecting women, or it's much more about kind of ensuring the restoration of, I quote, the moral fiber of society. Mm-hmm. So there's a very much a strong imposition of values, but the interpretation of this imposition of values is obviously harm, direct harm to sex workers. And raids on brothels, raids during, for example, the World Cup, the football mm-hmm. World Cup, it was merely an excuse, an opportunity to arrest sex workers perpetrate extensive and brutal violence against them and not receive any punishment or any attention to the matter. So I think it's actually coming from a wider agenda about ending sex work, and really the mechanisms and the procedures to do that, they go unspoken. So the police very much have impunity on that, and the abuse of power from the police obviously is extensive, and they abuse their power in many situations, but this I think is a particularly extreme example of abuse of power.
Thank you, Sean. Sienna, you talked a little bit about profiling, and I'd like to hear maybe a little more about what you think, how you think what some people might consider to be legitimate or necessary policing practices, actually, when paired with the confiscation of condoms, the use of condoms as evidence, end up doing people a lot of harm.
Yes, I think that one good way to look at that issue is to explain that in New York, in the United States, every state criminalizes prostitution slightly differently. In New York, we have two laws, two crimes for which people are arrested. They're both misdemeanors. One is prostitution, and the other is actually a violation and then a misdemeanor, and it's called loitering for the purposes of prostitution. And it's a law that, if you read the law, you quickly understand that it can be used very easily to profile. The acts that you have to be seen committing in order to be arrested for loitering for the purposes of prostitution is standing around in a public place and talking to passersby or talking to cars that are driving by with the intent deep in your heart and soul of committing prostitution, which the police cannot tell from far away. So it really enables police to look at someone who's standing around doing things that are perfectly legal and decide, because of the way they look, because of their gender, because of their race or ethnicity, because they've arrested them before, and so they're a known sex worker, decide that they are committing a crime of loitering for the purposes of prostitution. So we see, just generally in our work, this being used constantly to especially arrest transgender people and transgender women in New York. And we saw that also come out in the report, that transgender women were particularly affected by the condom confiscation. Condoms are confiscated often in these arrests for loitering for the purposes of prostitution. Just as another, besides seeing you standing around, I also found condoms on you. So another piece of evidence, given there's very little evidence. I just wanted to tell one story, a vague story, but of a client that we had that became our client, because she was arrested walking home from getting a drink at a store. She saw someone that she thought she knew. She started to talk to them. They ended up being an undercover police officer, and uniformed police officers tackled her and pushed her to the ground and asked her, "Do you have condoms? Show us your condoms." She was a transgender person, and clearly they thought she was interfering in something. They had no basis to arrest her, and so they tried to find one, and the only thing they could think of was, maybe if she's carrying condoms, we can, arrest her for prostitution. So we hear these stories, and we find in New York, they especially concern transgender women, but also, women, and with a skew towards Black and Latina people.
Thank you. I'd like to ask one more question of the panel and then open it up for the audience's questions. I know you must be eager to be part of this conversation. But one question, and any of you can chime in on this, that I really wanted to get to is the chasm between what is often government policy or programs to prevent HIV and to get condoms into people's hands, literally, and this police conduct that is taking condoms away. So how can we understand what seems like a crazy divide, and what are your thoughts about how we eventually bridge that gap? Anyone who wants to step forward, thank you.
Okay, I think because those are the questions that have been asked by sex workers when we conduct outreach, that the government is the one that's providing condoms for people to practice safer sex. But at the same time, the government is the one that is confiscating condoms. So it's kind of a confusing issue that is happening. But I think the government needs to be called in order. I think in this kind of meetings, we need to make sure that the government or part of people that are working for the government needs to be part of this so that they can hear that we are addressing this kind of issues. Because this is a bigger problem that is affecting sex workers. And at the same time, people there are saying sex workers are the ones that are capable of spreading diseases. But at the same time, police are the ones that are confiscating condoms. And that makes sex workers more vulnerable to all these kind of diseases. And we are trying as much as we can by having this kind of activities, outreaches, going to sex workers' areas where they work to provide condoms. And sex workers, they are trying their best to practice safer sex. So it is something that we need to support, not only in one country. I think countries as a whole, they need to intervene in this kind of issues. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to open it up to your questions, and just to note, there are two microphones that will be moving around, and I'll ask you to please introduce yourself. Please introduce yourself when you're asking a question, and please to keep your questions as pointed as possible and directed at a specific speaker, if possible. So. Gentleman standing up.
Most of your conclusion based on interview with sex worker. How much you can rely what they telling you? If you compare to same somehow similar situation when police stop a young man on the street, all of them exemplary students, good sons, they are good and so good. And police stop them, so innocent. So again, I have some idea about young men when police stop them. And honestly, my sympathy 100% with police. And I wish they do this more. But I have no idea how it worked with sex workers, how much you can rely on them. Why they would not tell you pity stories?
All right. Does someone want to take that question?
Maybe. They understand question.
Yeah.
Talk about the methodology a little.
Yeah.
That might be a good response.
First of all, I think he's asking about the methodology of the research and how much we can rely on sex workers' own testimony about their experience as the source of our information. And I think, you know, sex workers are the true experts on the realities of their lives and what they experience. And the fact that we've found such uniformity in the stories again and again in countries as completely different as Russia and Zimbabwe, the United States, I think really speaks to the commonality of that experience. I'm going to leave it here, and I'm going to ask you to please, again, direct your questions to the speakers and introduce yourself when you ask a question. Someone in the middle there. Is that right? we can take two questions.
Thank you.
Maxim
Mikikian, LGBTI Rights Initiative, OSF. You've mentioned that it is difficult for sex workers to file complaints against the violations that they experience from the police because that would mean disclosing also their work. And that would criminalize them as well. Are there any strategies to go around it, and how do you ultimately, do you employ strategic litigation as one of the strategies to deal with the situation that you've described? And if so, what are the ways that you find to go around this? Thank you.
Take one more question.
Hi, I'm Vivek Devan, recently with the Global Commission on HIV and the Law. And I have a couple of questions, one specifically to Kohli and the other to anyone who wants to take it. I have to say, though, that I mean, one of the things that we learned through this process of the Global Commission was that the realities that you described in the countries that you mentioned are tragically realities right across the world. And it's just a uniform, tragic story of abuse in my experience everywhere. The question of Kohli is that, you know, there was a judgment recently of the courts in South Africa, which sort of recognized, you know, the dignity of labor, et cetera, of sex workers. And I think my larger question is, how does stuff like that, which is happening in a high court somewhere, really impact or can it be translated into the daily lives of people? For instance, on this whole issue of criminalizing possession of condoms. The question to anyone who wants to take it is, one of the experiences has been that police are given incentives of quotas, you know, the number of people they arrest in a given day or a month and stuff. And of course, bribery and corruption is one serious issue. But I'm wondering if, for instance, in New York, is there a quota system that they have to satisfy to get a promotion or and stuff like that? I mean, it's, you know, worth thinking of law reform or rules and regulation reform in that context.
Do you want to take the first question?
Sure. And I think it's a whole symposium of itself to talk about the difficulty in sex workers and others, to be honest, in filing complaints against the police. There is the barrier that sex workers have of being afraid to file complaints, and that fear being based on real experiences where they've attempted to even just report a crime that they themselves have experienced as a crime victim and been laughed at, been turned away, been told that they got what they deserved. And these are stories we've documented in New York. I'm sure they're documented, you know, or can be documented around the world. And then there's also, at least in New York, I think a real difficulty with the system of complaints in and of itself, and a lack of accountability in terms of when you do file a complaint, whether it is going to be evaluated by someone who has any authority to take any action, or whether it's going to be evaluated by people that have less power than the police force itself. So I'm not an expert on those topics, but I know that there's also a real campaign to reform that system and make it more accessible. And then maybe Kohli can answer the...
Yeah, go ahead. Kohli, did you want to take the question focused to you?
Okay. To answer the questions that was asked at first, that the strategy that we're trying to come up with on for sex workers to be able to take cases forward, what we have done, we've got some attorneys that we work with, that we partners with, that those are the ones that are helping us to do some trainings around the human rights defense to sex workers, awareness on their rights, and also they are helping us to take those cases, that is Women's Legal Center and Utswaranang.
And the final question was about police quotas and arrest quotas and how that may play into this, whether sex workers are easy targets, I think, is maybe one of the implications.
If your question is about New York, I think that the current consensus is that there is a quota system, but it is unacknowledged by the police department, and it's in fact disavowed by the police department, but there's evidence that it is in practice happening. My observations of the policing of prostitution in New York is that it is inconsistent and follows trends. And it's always there, but there may be times when there is a real targeting of a certain neighborhood, a real targeting of a certain population, or certain kind of sex work, while others are not being targeted, and then that will shift. So I think that you're right. Street-based sex workers particularly are low-hanging fruit in terms of if police are trying to rack up a certain number of arrests.
Just on that point about quotas, we have a rather interesting situation in Zim where every so often there will be something happening. So maybe we need purchase of vehicles for ministers, etc. And then the police will be set quotas for the amount of money that they need to raise per day on fines. And again, similarly, often sex workers are extremely easy targets. For the police, it's disappointing because the bribes go down a little bit on that day because the fines have to go up.
Hi, I'm Kristen Canfield. I'm a correspondent with Media Global News. It's based at the UN, and we focus on development issues. So I'm particularly interested in the decriminalization of sex work and how policies to do that would address both involuntary sex work and underage women and men who are forced into sex work.
You want to target that to a particular speaker?
I think that's a really important question, and again, is another thing we could talk about for a long time. We do, at the Sex Workers Project, support decriminalization, and we do that because we know that the system that we have is not working. It has not eliminated the sex industry. It has not eliminated coercion in the sex industry or minors in the sex industry. It has only created these circumstances where sex workers can be abused and arrested, and arrests leading only to less opportunities and further kinds of abuse. So for those reasons, we do support decriminalization. We also work with minors. We work with people who are coerced into sex work. And we find that they are equally affected, sometimes even more affected, by criminalization of sex work because they have often less choices and less ability to protect themselves from arrest, from police encounters. And we haven't found that criminalization has led to any good outcomes for them either. So that's why we have the perspective that we have.
I wonder if I could just add a question to that and ask how decriminalization, you think, might help to resolve some of what we're seeing in terms of confiscation of condoms, police focus on condom possession.
I think decriminalization of sex work, it would makes the situation better. It would change the laws. People will have to respect that if I am carrying my condom, it's my choice, and I have to use my condom. I need to use protection to protect myself from diseases, from HIV and stuff like that. It will also help at this point. Let's say I'm, for an example, I'm 38 years old. At the moment, the work that I do is criminalized. It is difficult for me to intervene to underage, to intervene to if I see crime, because I'm mostly seeing those things. I'm out of the street most of the time doing my work, but it makes it difficult for me to intervene even if I see there is something wrong. So decriminalization of sex work, it would make the situation very much easier. Because even if I see underage, it would be much easier for me to identify it and go and report it to the police. Because at this moment, even if I see underage, some they work with pimps, stuff like that, but the pimps will think that because of I'm older, I'm kind of jealous, of which I'm not. Yes.
I think I was just going to say that I think it comes back to your earlier question about this reconciliation between HIV policies and the actions of the police, because I think this issue of criminal sanctions is hugely problematic in preventing the rollout of effective HIV policies. Mm-hmm. Recently, last year, the National AIDS Council in Zimbabwe commissioned a research, and the research found that the sodomy laws and the prostitution laws needed to be dealt with in a pragmatic way. Essentially, what they were saying is that those laws needed to be removed, and that research was never released to the public, and they refused to release it, because I think the point is about these criminal laws is that they're really creating hugely significant barriers. And I think the point about decriminalization, particularly from our perspective in Zimbabwe, is that by decriminalizing sex work, you're also maybe getting to the heart of the harm. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in which if you remove criminal sanctions, you can really now strengthen other laws that are really causing harm, and you can ensure that those mm-hmm. issues are being addressed more effectively. But I certainly think in terms of reconciling these health policies, criminal laws have to be removed. destructive, you know, dangerous criminal laws have to be removed.
Thank you. Yeah. Hi, my name is Robert Ciccone. In reference to what you just said, don't you think that the certain misogynistic motivation behind a lot of this persecution, in the same way as there's a racial motivation between the stop and frisk, I think these are things that have to be kind of addressed, you know, candidly without, you know, any shyness. Thank you.
Another question? Go ahead.
Agree.
Yeah. We could concur.
Sorry, one more right here and then get her.
I understand that this is discussion of prostitution, and you've been talking about women. Is there any reason to think about male prostitution abuse in any way? I'm just thinking, frankly, political power to help make it better by having a large other people involved in supporting this. Times are changing, and I just threw that in. Have you thought about that? Is that at all discussed? Okay. And that includes all the kinds of abuses we're talking about in relation to the female prostitutes?
Thank you for that question.
I
think we had one more question over here, and we'll take them as a couple, and then we can decide how to address that. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. My name is Melissa Shira Grant, and I'm here today on behalf of the Nation. And I have two questions. I'm sorry to pile on with even more. My one concern listening to this is what other institutions are propping up the police in doing this work. I've heard some reports of sex workers organizations in India who have been smeared in the press as, you know, these must be pimps handing out condoms, and have now even seen some feminist organizations using that same messaging, saying that we shouldn't be supporting programs that allow quote-unquote pimps to hand out condoms, and what they're actually talking about, it seems, are sex workers themselves doing health outreach. So I wonder if that is part of this environment that's making it possible for police to do this. And the second question is, what kind of positive movement or momentum do you see in the larger human rights and health community to support the work that you're doing?
I could talk to the first two. I think the first two actually go very well together, the first two questions. One is this a form of gender-based harassment? And two is, are male sex workers also affected? And I think both are true, even if that might seem contradictory. We also work with male sex workers. We work with sex workers of any gender. And in fact, 20% of the people that we interviewed in this survey were male. 26% were transgender female, and 45-6% were female. So we tried to capture information from a good cross-section of people that do sex work in New York. I think there are many male sex workers in New York, especially if we look at minors. It's been documented that there are more minor male sex workers than minor female sex workers in New York. So I think it is important to think about this not necessarily as an issue only affecting women. At the same time, those that we interviewed talked about the bias against LGBT people in New York as being a factor in this kind of harassment, that people who are perceived to be gay or perceived to be transgender or perceived to be of one of those sexualities or genders are especially targeted in these kinds of practices.
Anyone want to take on the question about other institutions, you know, propping up these kinds of police practices? Sean, you're nodding.
Agreeing completely with Sienna about this, the issue of misogyny. I mean, it's very much also heteronormativity in Zimbabwe as well, and that's a really additional factor, talking about intersectionality for the male sex workers that we work with, obviously that additional factor of the criminalization of sodomy. In parenthesis, but yes, going back to this idea of the institutions, I definitely, certainly in Zimbabwe, that the media is definitely supports police actions. That sounds a bit strange, but I think that the point is that the media feeds into this and kind of creates this atmosphere of disrespect for the human rights of particular groups.
I mean, it's interesting, actually, that we find it easier for non-state media to cover stories about sex workers' rights than for any media to cover LGBTI rights. So, I mean, there is definitely, that's very problematic in terms of actually exposing these issues. But there is definitely, the media are very unethical as well. When they cover stories of sex workers, there's no issues around consent. They publish names, they publish addresses. So there's also, it's just that sort of general disrespect, that real inhumanity, where there's just a sense in which, well, if you're a sex worker, you can be treated in this way, and you know, it's irrelevant how you feel. It's a very, very kind of dehumanizing. And I think that the media definitely plays into that. But I mean, I also think that certainly within the wider human rights discourse in Zimbabwe, there's very little kind of discussion around sex workers' rights, and the women's organizations, the women's movement, have found it very difficult. I don't know if it's the same in South Africa, to embrace sex workers' rights as an issue, but even just in terms of the discourse and trying, for example, to get something in the CEDAW shadow report around sex work was very, very challenging. So I think there's also, I mean, it's not necessarily about institutions kind of supporting directly, but the fact that they struggle to kind of include sex workers' rights within the wider human rights discourse obviously speaks to kind of a lot of barriers and a lot of stigma as well.
Just to add on that, in South Africa, we got a workshop that is called the Creative Space. For FSW, that is Female Sex Workers, is taking place on Wednesday. The MSM, that is Male Sex Workers, is taking place on Tuesday. So every day of that creative space, safer space for sex workers, we have a legal clinic where our attorney partners, they come and take statement, and then we take it from there. And around the abuse, the question that you've asked, just to answer it, I think when we talk about the abuse and all these kind of issues that are affecting sex workers, us in South Africa, we address the whole gender. It's sex work, it's FSW, it's MSM, it's LGBTI. They are mostly more vulnerable to these kind of issues because in people's mind, they think that sex workers are only female sex workers. They don't think that there is MSM in the LGBTI.
Thank you. One question in the back, and then second question back.
Hi, my name is Sanjay Patel. I work for Open Society in the Harm Reduction Program. And my job is to look at policing and how it relates to drug users. And one of the interesting encounters I had in Kyrgyzstan was questioning a women's IDU group, drug user group. And when asking them about what violence they encounter with the police, they didn't indicate anything specific. And then later on, when we were talking, they indicated that sometimes they are coerced into sex in order to get off a potential charge. And so what was interesting for me in that encounter was that they didn't see that as a form of violence. And so picking up, Sienna, on something you talked about in terms of you know, being coerced into sex as a form of bribery. And I'm just curious, in the work that you do, or I open this up to the rest of the panel if you want to answer as well, in the work that you do, do you find that sometimes sex workers, because they're so immersed in a world of violence and oppression, that sometimes they don't necessarily see some of the acts perpetrated by the police as necessarily violence? And if that does happen, what challenges does that pose to your advocacy, and how do you try to overcome that?
Okay. In South Africa, I would say, because of the work we do, it's criminalized, and it takes time for sex workers to understand that they've got rights. They also think that what is happening to them, it is okay, because the work that we do, it's in South Africa, it sees as crime. But what we do with our attorney partners and with the advocacy team in our offices, we run human rights defense training awareness to sex workers, and that is make the better change for sex workers to speak out about the human rights violation that they're experiencing. So they've managed to come and bring cases. That's why we're having a legal clinic in every Wednesday, in each every creative space that we're having in our in provinces.
I think that I would answer your question by saying it's not that our clients don't see it as violence. It's that occasionally, and we have we serve a very diverse client population. We serve sex workers of many income levels, of races, we serve sex workers who are immigrants, who are citizens, and they have really diverse experiences as well. I think our clients who face the most police brutality are also our clients who've endured a lot of violence in other parts of their lives and may see violence as a normal part of life. So, which doesn't mean they accept it or think that that's how it should be. I understand your question, and that's my response to it, is that I think our clients and also the people that we surveyed do identify it as violence, identify it as an injustice, but don't see any way to seek a remedy for it.
Hi, my name is Teresa Chain, and I'm an MD-JD student and an intern at Human Rights Watch for the summer. And I was really interested in asking first how the recently nationally implemented Secure Communities program has affected the local sex workers, but also if there were any synonymous situations abroad where the stigma against migrant communities were particularly strong and would factor into police brutality and targeting. Thank you.
Another symposium. I'm really glad you raised that question. Is everyone familiar with Secure Communities? No? Okay. Secure Communities is a program that is being rolled out by the federal government, which basically forces local police and state police to give information about the people that they encounter to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, our immigration police. And this might seem, especially to people maybe not in the United States, like, oh, well, is that happening already? There's actually been a pretty clear distinction between these two kinds of police in the US. For example, in New York, there was a policy that was created so that local police could not actually give information about the people that they, even the people they arrested or the people that came forward to them as victims of crime, they could not give any information about them to immigration. And for good policy reasons, because they wanted people, even undocumented people who might be subject to deportation, to still feel comfortable coming to the police for help. So Secure Communities sort of destroys that policy. And it has been activated in New York. It's something that's very scary to us because our clients, majority of our clients are immigrants. A majority of those immigrant clients are undocumented, and many of them are fleeing persecution in their home country. Many of them have escaped a human trafficking situation and many have many reasons why they cannot go back to their home country, and they'd be in danger if they did. But because they're sex workers, they also have a really hard time gaining immigration status. There are a lot of barriers and laws that prevent them from gaining immigration status. So they're in a very scary situation because they're also prone to being arrested and could end up just through a low-level arrest, like a prostitution arrest, end up in deportation proceedings. So those are the effects that we anticipate, and we're still figuring out how this is going to work and how we can respond in New York.
I wonder if one of our other speakers would also like to speak to the vulnerability of migrant sex workers in those interactions with police. Coley or Sean, do you?
I would say it is a huge problem, even in South Africa, because what police do, and they threaten to deport sex workers to their countries if they don't agree on what they've asked, like sexual favor, bribe, sometimes to handcuff them and escort them, to ask for money to the neighbors, so they're being exploited to the neighbors, even if people, they didn't know that they're sex workers. So that is a huge problem. But with the attorney partners that we work with, I think the situation is getting there, because in South Africa we've got the organization that we work with is based in Cape Town, and then in other provinces we've got the Sisonke movement. We've got offices that are based in six provinces. So police are aware, because we've taken some cases into court. We've opened cases into some of the against the police. We have spoken to the media around the abuse that the sex workers are facing. So there is an awareness to police. They are still taking advantages. But yeah, with our partners and the attorneys that we work with, we're getting there.
Sorry, I just wanted to say something specifically about, we don't have a lot of migrants in Zimbabwe right now, but there's a lot of Zimbabwean migrants in South Africa. Mm. And from my knowledge of issues, particularly in Johannesburg, which is the closest to the border. Mm. For a lot of Zimbabweans. Interestingly, a lot of the issues are around client violence. And you actually have horrific stories of sex workers being murdered, mm-hmm. and literally disappearing, and people not being able to find them. And I think interestingly, because I suspect they probably try to avoid the police as much as possible, and there's an awareness amongst the clients that these sex workers are foreign, or are migrants. So I mean, there's a shift there as well. And obviously, accessing any kind of support is very difficult, because often they don't have any kind of papers and have often crossed the border illegally. And I think one of the other challenges that seems to be happening as well is that the sex workers, there's a lot of vulnerability for sex workers at border posts as well, in terms of abuse from border post officials to get across, to cross over the borders. And the support often offered at border posts is often slightly reliant on the assumption that you don't want to be a sex worker, that you kind of have to be rehabilitated in some way. So it's also often it's not a very human rights-based approach. And so it's very problematic. And I think that it's an issue, particularly for Zimbabweans in South Africa, that requires a huge amount of research, because I actually think it's a very, very serious problem. And I think that a lot of sex workers have suffered a huge amount of harm as a result of their sort of invisible status in South Africa.
Mm. Okay, I think we'll take two more questions. First you, this woman here in the front had her hand raised.
Hi, I'm sure you get asked this question quite often, but my question is, how do you show that there is common ground between what your agenda is for sex workers' rights and the international agenda of many well-to-do organizations that are working to combat underage sex trafficking in order to foster more collaboration between your agenda and their agenda?
Just take one more question and think about who wants to respond to that.
Thank you. My name is Althea Anderson. I'm a gender and health research consultant. I do work on sexual violence prevention in South Africa. And my question is about, the panelists have given very, very strong reasons of the benefits of decriminalization and legalization in terms of the rights and well-being of sex workers. But one of the overarching problems is the sexual violence perpetration of police officers. And a policy change on decriminalization will not necessarily deal with sexual violence perpetrated by police on sex workers. And so my question, especially in South Africa, is that is there efforts to link police violence against sex workers to police brutality in other forms against communities?
Oli, do you want to take that the second question first, and then
question and then answering after. Okay. Okay.
And then we can take on the trafficking issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand that decriminalization it is something that we're looking at. It is something that we're calling for in South Africa. It will also help us. It will motivate sex workers to speak around the human rights violation, because at the moment we are
under the closet, it's difficult for us to speak out. Some sex workers do. By having these organizations that support the human rights of sex workers, it has helped the majority of sex workers to speak about human rights violation. So for us, decriminalization will change the laws. And I think that it will be much and simple easier for us to act against whoever was violating our rights.
I'd like to speak to that too and maybe tie it in your question. I think I couldn't agree more that decriminalization will, if that happened tomorrow, say in New York State, that it would not necessarily eliminate all harms against sex workers. And we've seen examples of countries where prostitution is not a crime, but there are all these other laws that kick in and allow police to harass sex workers, arrest them for other things, or impose civil penalties on them. I'm sorry? Well, let me think of a... There are examples. They're not coming to mind. Australia. your audience members can fill in that blank that I'm having. But it's a concern for us as well, I think, that could still occur. And I think I want to echo what Coley says, that it's about decriminalization, but it's also about what happens during a campaign for decriminalization where these stories start to get told and broader public start to think about what these harms are and start to have a cultural shift around stigma and around just the awareness of sex workers' issues. And that, I think, is another goal and another effect of, say, a campaign around decriminalization that could get at those other harms.
Before we close, I would like to give each of our speakers a chance to maybe say a few words about what you would like members of this audience to do based on the information that you've shared with them, or what you would most like us all to take away from this discussion. So again, Coley, if we can start with you.
Yeah, there are so many things that I would like the audience to do. I don't even know where to start, but I'll try to list important things. I would say I would like you people to assist the sex workers in your countries, because I know that in all countries there are sex workers. It is something that is not new. It did not start yesterday. It is something that has been there. I'm 38 years old, but I was born then, and sex working was still there. And then the other thing that I would like to say is to support the human rights of sex workers. I'm not sure if in all countries they're calling for decriminalization, but us in South Africa, we are calling for adult sex work to be decriminalized in South Africa. Also to support, if you've got programs that you work with sex workers in your countries, to give support and be on sex workers' shoes, and to get more information on what is happening to sex workers, you need to invite the sex workers in those kind of spaces so that you can get to understand what is happening in the industry. Like us in South Africa, we started the movement that is called Sisonke, meaning we are togetherness. And our aim is to have the movement in all provinces. And then our slogan is nothing about us without us. So we become happy if we are invited in these kind of spaces to participate and share our experiences. And talking from the horse's mouth, I think it's much better than people saying that the sex worker said this. But it is important for sex workers to be invited in those kind of spaces to share their experiences and challenges that they're facing. So I'm very much happy that you've given yourself time to come here and to listen to us. Please support all countries into sex workers' human rights support. Thank you very much.
I echo exactly what Coley said. I think one of the most important things is to ensure that space is created for sex workers to share their testimonies and to have their voices heard and to very much guide the dialogue and the discourse around sex workers' rights to really be leading any initiative for sex workers' rights. And I think creating spaces and platforms, just picking up a little bit on your question, spaces and platforms to find commonalities, to hopefully share agendas, and to share platforms at sort of an international level in terms of the fact that, as Koli said, national campaigns need support, but also equally from Zimbabwe and South Africa and Russia and Namibia, there are many important experiences that we need to share. And I think there are commonalities with other organizations working internationally at a higher level. And I think creating the space for sex workers to engage at that level, because their voices are extremely important, and I think they're often absent from the dialogue and from the discourse. So I think those would be the two take-home messages that I would leave with you.
And I would echo everything that was said and maybe just add a message to the HIV/AIDS advocacy community and the public health community. We're heading into the International AIDS Conference in a week, the first time it's been in the United States in 22 years. And in the United States, I'm sure all over the world, so much attention, funding, care, research has gone into making safe sex okay and messaging and communicating these messages. And then on the other hand, we have this blind spot where sex workers are getting that message, and then they're getting the message that it's okay if you contract a life-threatening illness. We don't care, and that without sex workers' rights organizations to alert us to this fact, it would have just not been known. And so I think that public health organizations, public health funders, public health institutions need to have some moral courage and come out in favor of the kinds of changes that we're proposing.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like you all just to thank me. Thank me. I'd like you to thank the panelists and Acacia for an amazing panel, and also for all the work that really went into the research and the report. So thank you very much. And if you're interested to have any follow-up questions or to speak with any of the panelists, please feel free. And also on the table over there are some of the reports as well as some other resources. And if any of you will be at the International AIDS Conference, we'll be having a similar event, but different, on Monday the 23rd at the Human Rights Networking Zone at 2:30. And I would just also like to close real quick with another thanks, which is to Rachel Thomas, there she is in the back, who really was the vision and also the force behind all of the report and all of the products. And thank you to you all again for coming out tonight. Thanks.